Accession number 22170, Reel 5.
Nick Berryman, Reel 5.
Group captain came down, offered me my £2.13 and 6 pence, and I put in a claim for that, and chucked my watch into a bowl of a broken compass. And my father, being the sort of bloke he was able to have that watch repaired for me. And until I lost it about 18 months ago, I wore it for very much on. And it had been in salt water for ages. That's another story. And I don't know why I should ever have been chosen as a Warwick pilot, God alone knows. So I was flying the Spitfires in the morning and the Warwicks in the afternoon. The Warwicks in the afternoon, Spitfires in the morning, the Warwicks, the Spitfires, Spitfire Warwicks, and they were so unalike.
But was it hard to adapt?
Terribly, terribly hard. Terribly hard to adapt. In fact, it was because of the trying to adapt that caused another rather stupid mistake of mine, because say I was flying the Spitfires, and you do so much by sound, you know what the revs are on an engine, and of course the engine on the Warwick was entirely different to this inline powerful engine of the Spitfire, and I was mix and match and going out on rescues, going out on searches on the Spitfire. And then I would be expected to do standby and perhaps do some sea landings and rescues.
Did you pilot the Warwick?
Yes, indeed. I was taught to fly the Warwick in Poole Harbour. The chap called Jimmy Renboys, who was a Battle of Britain pilot, he had been flying Gladiators in the Battle of Britain with 249 Squadron. 247. And they were the only biplane fighters to fly in the Battle of Britain. But Jimmy Renboys was my flight commander. And he was a good Warwick pilot, and he taught me to fly the Warwick. And I took to it pretty well. I liked flying the Warwick. In retrospect, it was the most exciting aeroplane I ever flew. Because when you look at it, with its two wings and its pusher engine, you think, what a lumbering old cow. But you could take off on the land, you could fly in the air, you could land on the water, you could take off on the water, fly in the air, land on the land. It was a flying speedboat. And believe you me, a 21-year-old kid can treat it like a flying speedboat, and I did. I had more fun out of wars, more excitement, more danger than I ever met in the fighters.
You talked earlier about challenge.
It was a challenge. If you get down, you see, when you're landing a walrus in a rough sea and the body's of the bloke, you've got to get down. You can't let the bloke die. You've got to get down. And you've got tumbling waves. So you've got to judge it as to when you drop it into that deep sea. So you fly it and fly it and fly it with its nose up and its tail down with bags of engine on, and then slam your throttle off to try and drop it at the top of a swell. And as you drop it on the top of the swell, with any luck, down into the swell you go, up the other side, fall off the top into the next trough. Well, it didn't always work like that. Sometimes you judged it a bit wrong and you hit the top of the swell and bounced off and water would pour in all over the place, and then the thing would come to a wallowing, grinding, shaking, water ridden heap, and then somehow you'd got to turn it around and rescue the bloke in the water.
Would you have known what to expect when you arrived, what condition?
Yes, you could always, you dropped a smoke float as soon as you saw anything in the water. You dropped a smoke float to mark it straight away. Many a bloke must have thought we were bombing him. But that was to mark him, because you could lose that figure, only the head you ever saw, in the water.
You wouldn't have known the condition of the men.
No, and you didn't know the condition of the men. But having got down in the sea, of course, having got the bloke out of the water, or people out of the water, the object was then to take off and fly back to base, but you were probably in the middle of the English Channel. You know, you were 50 miles out.
Did you ever rescue very seriously injured?
No. No. The nearest I got to that was a Polish pilot that was rescued about 15 miles south of Bournemouth. And I made a tremendous mistake, two mistakes in probably in the same months. I dropped the walrus in too near France for a start, and the wind was blowing from France. I got down in the water, and the water was terribly, terribly rough, and I could not turn the aeroplane round. I could not turn it round. It weathercocked into wind all the time. It didn't matter how much throttle and rudder I was putting on to turn the aeroplane round. I could not turn it round. He was a Polish pilot, and the language of the Polish CO up above me, calling me all the silly buggers under the sun over the RT because I couldn't turn this thing round. He didn't know the difficulties I was experiencing. But that was beside the point. And he was rescued by one of the torpedo boats. So he was okay. At the same time, because of the difference in the... And then, of course, I did turn it round, and I did it in the lee of a cargo ship coming into Poole Harbour. And I got into the lee, the wind was... The ship came across me, I was able to turn it round, I got in the wake and taxied in the wake of the cargo ship back into Poole Harbour, where the Navy got me thoroughly drunk, and it was the most spectacular takeoff you've ever seen from Poole Harbour in a walrus. However, I got back in one piece to Warmwell, but the other thing I was going to tell you about the difference between the engines and the sound of the engines and how you flew things. I was going to taxi out with a Spitfire one day, and you notice I'm wearing a tie pin. Ever since I've been a boy at Mercer School, I've worn a tie pin. I think in the main it's been the same tie pin. I couldn't be sure of that, but certainly it's a tie pin I had all the war. And I was just doing a scramble on a Spitfire, and my number two was alongside me, and Jimmy Renboy's standing within shouting distance of me. He said, "Get your tie off." I said to the mechanic, "What's he say?" He said, the mechanic climbed on the wing. He said, "Get your tie off." I said, "I'll tell him to get knotted or something like that." Anyway, he was right, quite right, because if you in the sea and you ditch, the tie can tighten up and choke you. And he always used to insist that the tie came off. Well, I didn't take my tie off, but in bad temper, I shoveled underneath my May West, and I got my tie off, and I threw it at the mechanic, and then, full of high dudgeon and bad temper, I swung the aeroplane round, gave my number two a thumbs up, and I revved the engine and put the bloody thing straight up on its nose, right up on its nose. So, on the front of my book, it has the same Spitfire, AQD, forgetting the P number it was. I put the photograph of it because Jimmy Renboys took the photograph. And years later, I met him at a reunion. And I was looking for this man with a sloping forehead and a slightly hooked nose. And finally, I found what I thought was the man. I hadn't seen him for 30 years. And we were up in Shropshire. And I saw a bloke standing there with a pint pot in his hand. And I came up to him and I said, "Jimmy Renboys?" And he said, "Nick Barron." I said, "Yes, do you remember me?" And like a man that had waited 35 years to do so, he put his hand in his pocket and produced this photograph that I'd never seen of this Spitfire on its nose. On its nose, and I've got that photograph. And on the front of the book that I've written, I've got AQD standing on its nose with a little rhyme. And the little rhyme says, "What did you do in the war, Daddy? Shot down a few Huns, I suppose." "I'm not too sure of that, laddie, but I did put a spit on its nose." And it was, of course, the difference in the sound of the revs of the engines that really had confused me. And as any pilot can make a mistake, you know. But I wasn't very proud of making that one. So I got a red endorsement in my logbook that said, "Carelessness."
Did you have to talk to anyone about it? Intelligence officer?
Oh, yes, I got my knuckles wrapped. And you know, my logbook's in the museum. And if we ever get that out, I can turn it back on the pages for you. And there somebody will have put, "Taxiing accident, carelessness."
Next visit.
Next visit. That's right. And anyway, of course, I was corresponding with Ray McNair Taylor, and he had the dog with him. And then he wrote to me and said, "Would you be best man of my wedding?" And in the August of 1943, I was very pleased to meet his wife for the first time, and at the wedding. And the wedding took place in Croydon, and I was his best man. Later on, of course, sadly, he was killed. And but there goes
that
another.
Year?
He was killed in 1944, but that is the story goes completely out of timing. But let's get out of time. It doesn't matter,
does it?
Ray McNair Taylor married Valerie. I was best man at their wedding. From 276 Squadron, I was at the end of the year posted to 294 Squadron, to the Middle East. While I was in the Middle East, flying the Walrus, or North Africa in the Mediterranean, I was saddened to hear suddenly from my father that Ray had been killed flying a Spitfire. His wife, Valerie, had previously been married to another friend of ours who was killed flying a Hawker Typhoon. So there was this poor lass, widowed twice in 2 years. And but they had a son, and I was godfather to their son. And eventually I came back to this country and to collect my dog that was with Valerie. Or he wasn't actually, because he'd been banished to Manchester. He was such a wicked boy. But anyway, somebody was looking after him in Manchester. And I collected him in Manchester, and I re-met Valerie again, and met my godson, who was then only 3 months old. And I asked Valerie to marry me virtually then and there, and 6 months later we were married. And fortunately we had another child. Another 9 months went past, and the child came along very quickly. And those two boys are absolutely great pals. And I was, before I came to you today, my son, who is now an airline pilot with Monarch, and he flies the Airbus, having been in the Air Force and flown the Hunter, the Canberra, the Hawk. He had a son in his turn who also went in the Royal Air Force. So we're very Air Force family. And very proud of that. So I left Nicholas at home now, because he'd just been to Bahrain and he wanted to see his mother. So he does a quick buzz down, so I left him having lunch with his mother while I came to see you. And but where are we, Air Force-wise? I'm still flying the Spitfires with 276 Squadron out of Warmwell. From 276 Squadron at Warmwell, it became very apparent that any time at all, we were going into 1944, and the first plans for the invasion had been made. In fact, I remember flying a Spitfire into Gravesend, and even in 1943, with invasion markings on. And of course, we didn't know what they were, but the invasion black and white markings were on our Spitfires when I flew into Gravesend in 1943. I was knowing full well there were a lot of changes going on. The Americans came in and took over Warmwell to a great degree with their P-38 Lightnings. And I found myself as a Spitfire pilot on search and rescue at Portreath, still with 276. But by this time, I was really a very experienced pilot, forest pilot. And there were several of the boys that weren't as experienced as I. So I was being used as a flying instructor as well for the walrus. And it was because of that, I suppose, that when a walrus pilot was required in the Middle East, I wasn't quite chosen, because I got very fond of a lady who was a WAF officer, and she got me out of a bit of trouble in the Spitfire over Plymouth, and I was fog bound for about another 2 days, and I went to meet this girl called Susan Harris. She was what was known as an Ops B officer, and their job, of course, was plotting the movement of aircraft. And I'd only been with her for about 24 hours, and I realised I'd really fallen in love with this dame, and she had with me, and we had quite a lot of very innocent fun, and it was nice, innocent, loving fun. To such a degree, we were so careful with what we did by being alone at any time. I remember being in the WAF mess one night when she said, "Be very careful, don't make an awful noise when you come through the front door." So I stayed in her room chatting away and having a coffee, because girls in those days were very circumspect, you know, they'd be a bit careful about their reputation. And I had a coffee with her in her room, and it got round to about 9 o'clock, and she suddenly says, "It's 9 o'clock, you'd better go." And her room was on the ground floor. So I made for the door, and she said, don't go out through the front, everybody will see you going out. God. So I said, "All right, I'll go out through the window." So I opened this ground floor window and cocked my leg over the windowsill, and I sitting astride the windowsill, and I turned around and I said, "Good night, Sue." Blew her a kiss, came face to face with a three-ring WAF officer who said, "Good evening, flying officer, are you going in or coming out?" God, was I embarrassed. So, anyway, from there, it became pretty apparent that Susan and I were going to get hitched. But I was funking out, and when I got an opportunity to volunteer to go to North Africa, I did, because I knew I wasn't ready for marriage.
What age were you then?
Exactly 21. I still got the cufflinks she gave me when I was 21. And on the back of them they have the words Mizpah, which means God be between me and thee whilst we're apart. And in her room she always kept a photograph of me and around it she was a vicar's daughter from Torquay. And around this photograph she had the exact words that you see written in the memorial at Runnymede. Psalm 29. "If I go to the uttermost parts of the sea, even there." So, anyway, I didn't marry her. But a bit later on in the story I'll tell you she was happily married.
Do you think she took it badly at the time?
I don't know. I myself wasn't ready to marry, and when the opportunity came, and it was either me or this bloke Warren Oz, a bird that done his best to drown me in the walrus, one of us had to go to the Middle East, and I said I'll go. He wanted to go back to Canada, and the opportunity was for him, and I was adventurous, so I said I'll go, and I went to the Middle East, and I'm sitting round expecting that I would not be posted as an air sea rescue pilot. I thought I would be certainly posted to another fighter squadron, or at least to another OTU as an instructor, or something like that. Because by this time, I'd done all of 18 months, and I was due for a rest myself. But having, and I didn't know it was going to be the Middle East, I thought it was going to be Italy. But having got to Egypt and seeing a damn great big sign up that said Port Said welcomes you, to Hague's Whiskey, I think it was written on the wall, I decided that, yeah, here I was in Egypt. And after about 4 days, I was bound off. By this time, I was a flight lieutenant. I was feeling my rank a bit. I wasn't going to be beggared about. And I went...
What do you mean by that, feeling your rank?
I had some seniority. I wasn't a pilot officer. I wasn't a flying officer. I'd done 18 months of war. I'd proved my point. I knew I wasn't a bad pilot and I wasn't going to be buggered about. So I said, I went up to headquarters of Middle East and I heralded a wing commander up there and I said, I haven't come out here, sir, to sit on my bum in a transit camp. He said, well, what do you do? I said, I'm a Spitfire pilot that flies the walrus. Walrus, he said, we need one on 294 Squadron. He said, you're going out in the desert. And sure enough, up to the desert I went. At the moment I went up into the desert, that was where I met my Australian air gunner for the first time. And we were at the Hotel David in Alexandria, having been in a transit camp called Al-Maza. I'm standing in the back of this lorry going up the coast road to LG-91. LG-91 was at Amaria. This was just about as far as the Germans ever got with the push back to try to get into Egypt. Well, they were in Egypt, but they didn't push as far as Alexandria, because Amaria was about sort of 40, 50 miles away from Alexandria. I'm standing alongside an air gunner in Australian uniform, and had no great coat. I had great coat. I had gloves. All he had was his ordinary number one tunic and no gloves, hanging onto this bumping gharry going up the coast road. I could see he was frozen to the bone. And it was difficult for him to hold on. So I took off one of my gloves, put my hand in my pocket, held on with one hand, and said, put that on. From then on out, he used to always introduce me as the only decent pommy bastard I've ever met. But I loved him dearly. And I'm sad he's no longer with us. But when we got to 294 Squadron, because we were both new boys, we were put into a crew. And our navigator was a navigator called Gibbons, Flight Lieutenant Gibbons, and he had come from Mauritius, where he'd been on Catalinas in Mauritius. Or was it the Seychelles? One or the other. I think the Seychelles, now I come to think of it. It was the Seychelles Islands. Because this is obviously a history lesson, I've got to try and get it right. So Gibby, I, and Bill Ransfield, the Australian, got crewed up. They had never flown with a pilot of my type before, because don't forget, I was half fighter pilot, half walrus pilot, and I was quite capable of throwing this machine around like a hurricane and a Spitfire, and I did. I used to roll it and loop it, and I used to frighten the life out of them. And they'd never, Bill had never ever landed a walrus in the water. He'd never been on the water, and a few rough sea landings, believe you me, it woke him up to what life was all about. He was tough, was Bill. He used to take bottle tops off with his teeth, and when he got really drunk, which he used to occasionally do, he used to say, here's to the breezes that lift the chemises from little girls' kneeses. It pleases and teases Oh, Jesus, oh, Jesus, oh, Christ. He was a lovely man. Brave as a lion. Got me out of many a hole. Liked him very much. Anyway, with 294 Squadron, I started operating out of, first of all, Amarillo, LG-91. Then I got posted up the desert to Benghazi, where we nearly lost an airplane by going out on a rescue for some Germans, four Germans we went out to pick up. They were picked up by a British destroyer, thankfully, but on the way back to the North African coast, I had an engine failure, and I managed to put the Walrus down in not too bad a sea. And Bill got on his WT, and he, when and about an hour and a half later, a boat came out from Derna and put us on the end of a bit of rope, and we sat for 6 hours on the end of this bit of rope, towed back into Derna Harbour, where we contacted sandfly fever, which gives you dreadful tummy trots. And so we all got that, and the engine was repaired after about 3 days. Some of the boys at Derna were due for leave, and by this time, of course, the Hun had disappeared through Sicily and were going up into Italy, so we weren't exactly in immediate danger. So when people could get leave, they used to go back to Alexandria to get leave. Back they go, so I managed to take this Walrus off with about seven on board out of Derna Harbour, and we flew back to Gambut. But by the time I got to Gambut, the three of us were a bit desperate to go to the loo. We were, and my gunner and my navigator were absolutely red in the face with their legs moving a bit fast. So when I got to Gambut, I could see the sand coming off the sand desert, and I called in and said, Lucas 17 or whatever my number was, I'm calling for emergency landing. So knowing full well we had to get on the ground a bit quick, you know, we really had to, and so I took up an immediate landing position, landed the airplane, and literally flew it towards the toilets, where they jumped out the back, leaving me having forgotten to. I switched off, but I forgot to unplug my radio connection, and I'm hanging out by the neck out of the front cockpit, struggling to get my buttons undone. Anyway, by the time I got there, they were ensconced in a two-holer. Well, there was a three-holer, but now somebody else was in the third one, and I had no option but to go round the back. So round the back I went, and then ops rang up and said, what was the emergency landing? And so somebody in headquarters flight said the crew had the shits. So anyway, and Bill was a rascal, but they were fun days really. The flying was good. Flying was dangerous. I had all sorts of comic things happen. A couple of engine failures on the old Walrus. But I got out of trouble each time. And then I was pretty saddened to hear that Ray McNair Taylor had been killed. And Valerie was widowed for the second time. I had no thoughts about marriage at the time, but I knew I'd got a godson. And I was coming to the end of my tour. Bill Dransfield was going to be posted back to Australia. D-Day had come. June the 6th had come and gone. My total contribution to that was to try and sink a mine in a shipping lane. Took us about an hour and a half, what with my piloting and Bill's gunnery. But anyway, we sank it, and we obviously saved a ship from perils. And but that was during the 6th gun. Then it got on, and Ray was killed, and I heard that he had been killed. And then I volunteered to go to Burma on PRU, Photographic Reconnaissance. I knew I could fly the Spitfires, I was happy with them, and I would go on to PRU in Burma. No, I don't know who made the rules, but I was put on an airplane and told to act as second pilot flying a Dakota back to England. And so my total time in North Africa was about 10 months. And this never happened to anybody. That if you went abroad, you would go east. Because, I mean, why not send me east?